This show furnished by Girardi Keys.
This is Champions of Justice, presented by Tom Girardi. Hello, I'm Dave Dino, and this is the program that takes you behind the scenes with those who make the laws and those who protect your rights through the rule of law. Your hosts are attorney Tom Girardi and attorney Bob Finnerty. Tom Girardi is the founding partner of the law firm of Girardi & Keys, known for passionate litigation of corporate giants on behalf of aggrieved individuals. He is a member of the California State Bar Trial Lawyer Hall of Fame, and is widely regarded by his peers as one of the nation's top trial lawyers. Joining Tom today, Bob Finnerty, a member of Girardi & Keys specializing in the areas of toxic torts, product liability, professional negligence, catastrophic personal injuries, and insurance bad faith. He has been chosen as a Los Angeles Magazine Southern California Super Lawyer, well, more than you can count on both hands. They are champions of justice for the little guy. Now, today, our topics. Does facial hair affect a jury's verdict? Can lawyers background check potential jurors? How does the female factor affect a juror? Do TV court dramas hinder real-life jurors? It may sound like the premise of a top-rated TV drama, but jury consultation is real and effective. And our guest today is in the thick of the issue. He is Dr. Philip K. Anthony, the Chief Executive Officer of Decision Quest, Inc., a trial consulting and strategic communications firm with offices in Los Angeles, Chicago, Houston, Pennsylvania, San Francisco, New York, Boston, Washington, D.C., Atlanta, and Minneapolis. Over a career spanning more than 30 years and more than 1,300 civil trials in all 50 states, Dr. Anthony has built a reputation as one of the nation's leading and most sought-after trial consultants. He has offered unique legal insights on CBS News, NBC News, and National Public Radio, and has been quoted in publications such as The Wall Street Journal, The LA Times, The New York Times, Time Magazine, U.S. News and World Report, USA Today, Business Week, and the San Francisco Examiner, among many others. Now, the principals of Decision Quest have been retained in more than 18,000 high-risk engagements, so we have a lot to talk about today. And, Tom, one might say that here at the beginning of the program, the jury is still out on how we will do.
Hi, everybody. Hey, thank you for joining us. It's really nice of you to spend a little time with us each week and talk about new and interesting things in the legal arena. Okay, Dave Dino, this time we did it.
Yeah.
We got the smart guy this time, Dave Dino. I'm not kidding you on this one. And when I told three of the partners at the firm that this terrific graduate of USC, they were not happy. They were wondering if
they, right over here.
They were wondering if we could get like a UCLA guy or something, you know, for at least 10 minutes.
I've got my jersey in the office.
Yeah. Anyway, Dave Dino, what this man does is really phenomenal. He assists lawyers, primarily in the trial consulting arena. You know, what sort of arguments are effective to a jury? He's also spends most of his time trying to make sure we get a fair and impartial jury. You know, Dave Dino, it's pretty hard when you have 3 minutes to talk to somebody about knowing that person's inner thoughts about things. And the last thing that we want in the justice system is for someone to decide a case not based upon the evidence, not based upon what happens during the trial, but what has happened to that person over the years or the thought process that person has, etc. And indeed, to make sure we have a fair jury, it's important that we find out perhaps those people that can't be fair for one way or another. Maybe some person hates insurance companies and wants to give $1 trillion to a plaintiff. Maybe another jury, no matter what the facts are, they don't want to be fair to that plaintiff, etc. And so somehow although lawyers, Dave Dino, are very good at putting on evidence, lawyers aren't so hot, maybe, on seeing the under the surface of those prospective jurors. Mm. And indeed, this great talent of a man who's with us is great at it.
I saw in my reading that not only does he provide consultation on picking a fair and impartial jury, but he also is very effective in giving advice to attorneys, particularly younger attorneys, in their courtroom demeanor and in how perhaps their actions or their looks might affect a jury's opinion, either of them, their case, or of the evidence that's being presented.
Pretty good, huh, Dave?
Yeah.
You know? Matter of fact, just in spending a little bit of time with this wonderful man, I decided, holy Toledo, how did I ever try any case without him? You know? Hey, listen, welcome to the show. I'm not kidding you on this.
Thank you, Tom. I appreciate those kind words. Thank you, Dave. I hope to live up to all those wonderful words.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
So how does this work?
Well, you know, as you started out, Tom, one of the most interesting and I think rewarding factors is that we have a jury-eligible population of about 230 million people in the United States. By jury-eligible, I simply mean these are folks who meet the criteria to potentially serve as jurors in cases.
Mm-hmm.
But a couple of things are really fascinating, and it's been true as long as I've been in this field. And, Tom, you've been a very successful trial lawyer for many, many years, I know, and you've seen the same thing. And that's simply this. First of all, jurors everywhere, people who end up serving as jurors, they want to do the right thing more than anything else in their makeup. When they're put in that box in the courtroom, and ultimately they're sworn in to serve as a juror, if it hadn't already hit them, it suddenly does hit them that they're providing a very important duty and civic service.
Having served on a jury, I can recall exactly what you're talking about, and that is when we were sworn in as a jury, I suddenly realized that the person sitting out at the table, I was going to have a very direct effect upon that person's life.
That's exactly right. And this is the kind of thing, as you just shared, Dave, this is the kind of thing that hits most jurors everywhere across the land.
Yeah.
It dawns on them that, oh my gosh, I'm doing something really important here, and I'm going to impact a person's life. Now, so that's point one. Point two, which goes hand in hand with that, is if you look at the jury-eligible population of the United States, 230 million individuals. Statistically, what you see, and this factor remains true in just about any part of the country to which you travel, statistically, only about 12 to 15% of those people have ever served as a juror.
Wow.
So for the other, let's call it roughly 200 million, if they show up in a courtroom, it's probably their first time. It's probably the first time they've ever been in a courtroom. They probably have not themselves been involved in a legal dispute, other than maybe something simple, a contract over something. And the interesting thing is it dawns on them very quickly that they don't really know what it is that's expected of them.
Mm-hmm.
So they revert to what's familiar to them. And what's most familiar to the layperson in America are things like what they see on television, what they've read about in the media, experiences which have been shared with them by neighbors and friends. And so most lay people who serve as jurors come into the courtroom with a very distinct impression of how the process works. Now, the interesting thing is that impression, which they have all been led to as a result of media, television, and so forth, is not typically in sync with what actually happens in a courtroom. The courtroom is a very precise place, as it should be, and a courtroom typically follows very precise rules and regulations. And so jurors wonder about that, and they wonder lots of things. So the first thing they wonder is, what's expected of me? But the second thing they wonder, generally speaking, is, well, what's this all about? What am I here to make a decision about? And, you know, many times that the answer to that question is not obvious, even when the court believes it has stated the purpose of the trial to the jury. The jury wonders, what's it all about? And third, they wonder, well, how am I supposed to make use of this information being presented to me, these facts, which come in the form of evidence and testimony? And how can I use these facts and evidence to make a fair decision in the case? Because when you speak to jurors, and again, this is true all across the land, when you speak to jurors after trials have ended, and you ask them, how do you feel about what you went through and the experiences you've had? Almost all.
They say it was great.
They say it was great. That's exactly right, Tom. They say it was great, but they also say, I just wonder sometimes at night, I wake up and I wonder, did I do the right thing? And fortunately, at least in my opinion, and I'm sure Tom feels the same way, in most instances, jurors do, in fact, do the right thing.
Hey, Dave Dino, when I look at the cases I've won and also look at the cases I've lost, I think that jury did the right thing in almost every single time.
You know, and you say that with even the cases you've lost.
Absolutely.
Wow.
And the interesting thing is, too, you know, you get people from all walks of life. On the other hand, walking into a courtroom, that man or woman in the black thing sitting up there about 3 feet higher than everybody else, the instructions that that judge now starts giving that jury, there's a whole nother philosophy that takes place. And I think for most people, they set aside their personal views on things.
Mm-hmm.
I've had many jurors after a verdict come to me and say, hey, Tom, I found in your favor in this case. I don't really want to go and tell the office that because, you know, we don't. But you know what? In really looking at this closely, this was the right thing to do.
Yeah.
And Dave Dino, it's such a wonderful system, this jury trial deal, to have people who don't have a dog in this hunt, who come down and then give up their time and so forth, and to try to do the right thing is really terrific.
You are listening to Champions of Justice with Tom Girardi, joined today by Bob Finnerty. Our guest is Phil Anthony. He is the CEO of Decision Quest, Inc. I'm Dave Dino, and we'll be back with more in just a moment here at Talk Radio 790 KABC.
The March of Dimes and HCA Healthcare are committed to the best possible start for every baby. I'm Amy Casseri, Vice President of HCA Women and Children's Services, where we have the honor of delivering over 200,000 babies a year. We partner with the March of Dimes on research and fundraising to help build a brighter future for babies everywhere. So march with us on one of the many HCA teams assembled nationwide. Learn more at marchforbabies.org/HCA.
Napa Know How.
Napa Night Vision Premium Capsules are up to $10 off a pair. They provide some of the best nighttime illumination of any headlamp. And if you can't see how good of a deal that is, then it's time you did something to clear up that view. Like getting Napa Night Vision Premium Capsules for up to $10 off. Quality parts, helpful people. That's Napa Know How.
Napa Know How.
At participating Napa Auto Parts stores. Offer expires 3/31/18.
Napa Know How.
Napa Night Vision Premium Capsules are up to $10 off a pair. They provide some of the best nighttime illumination of any headlamp. And if you can't see how good of a deal that is, then it's time you did something to clear up that view. Like getting Napa Night Vision Premium Capsules for up to $10 off. Quality parts, helpful people. That's Napa Know How.
Napa Know How.
At participating Napa Auto Parts stores. Offer expires 3/31/18.
The March of Dimes and HCA Healthcare are committed to the best possible start for every baby. I'm Amy Casseri, Vice President of HCA Women and Children's Services, where we have the honor of delivering over 200,000 babies a year. We partner with the March of Dimes on research and fundraising to help build a brighter future for babies everywhere. So march with us on one of the many HCA teams assembled nationwide. Learn more at marchforbabies.org/HCA.
Welcome back to Champions of Justice with Tom Girardi, joined today by Bob Finnerty. Our guest is Dr. Philip Anthony. He is the CEO of Decision Quest. And we're talking today at this point in the program about juries, jury selection, and the attributes of a good jury. Bob?
Dr. Anthony, I see that you're a social psychologist.
That's correct.
I'm not sure that I've heard that term before. Well, you're shaking your head, yes.
Well, all it means is simply that my formal training back in my days in school was in the field of social sciences. So I didn't study the hard sciences. I studied the soft sciences, which includes topics such as psychology, communication behavior, anthropology, sociology. And my whole focus in that field, which is true of many of the folks who practice as trial consultants across the nation, my whole focus was to understand human behavior at a broad level, meaning I'm not the guy who sits with someone on the couch and the person tells you their personal life story. I'm the guy who wants to understand how do broad swatches of the population respond to issues that are put before them. What's the thought process that takes place? Why are they thinking the things that they are? And most importantly, to the point that Tom made earlier, we're trying to understand what it is that jurors might not understand about the trial. Because a big part of our role, and the reason I even have a job, is that there are many jurors who, again, we'll go back to what we talked about earlier, they want to do the right thing, but they're not certain what the path to doing the right thing might be. And so what we learn in the course of our work is that there are certain things about every trial which jurors simply don't understand. They either don't understand the underlying fact or principle, or they don't understand how the fact or principle applies to the particular trial on which they are seated.
And yet, you were talking about how people reacted after the fact to having served on a jury.
Yes.
And you compare that to how people feel before the fact about being called for jury duty. That's a very different public sentiment, isn't it?
It is. It is indeed. And I, again, I think, Dave, as Tom mentioned earlier as well, it's a cathartic experience for jurors, meaning they come in with one set of expectations and views, and they leave with a different set of experiences.
I have a question for you, Tom. When you are in front of a jury, what are you looking at and what are you looking for?
Well, I need a little guidance from somebody like my pal here today. Because although, you know, you and I, Dave Dino, can go down there and we'll get some pretty good feelings about some of the folks. But indeed, some of the inner thoughts are best left up to someone who has the background of our guest, that background in psychiatry and psychology and has gone through all of these jury selection processes. So it's very easy to get the handle on some juror that says, I think plaintiff lawyers are a bunch of idiots, or I think companies harm everybody, or, okay, fine, well, those people aren't going to sit on the jury. What you really have to find out is some inner thoughts that people have that could affect your case that doesn't really appear on the surface. You know, Dave Dino, and a person I bet you know, there's a Dr. Hill, and he examines the face. And your face has 44 muscles that go directly to the skin. All other places in your body, those go to bone. And those muscles react before you say something. It's instantaneous. But they'll show happiness. They'll show sadness. They'll show contempt. They'll show those things before you actually verbalize something. And it's very interesting to try to get the very inner thoughts of jurors. A lot of it, I think, depends upon the questions that people are asked to try and get their inner thoughts about what they think about things. But indeed, to have somebody at your side, like this man right here, is massively important. Because although I've tried a lot of jury trials, I haven't tried 18,000 of them. So what do you do?
So,
okay, I know you do some things. I'm going to stay on the jury stuff right
yes,
now.
Yes, right.
And then we're going to talk about some other
right.
stuff.
So one thing, Tom, I appreciate the comments you just made, but one thing I think maybe the listeners would like to know is people like us are not out in the world investigating individuals. Mm. We're not following people around or trying to somehow spy on them, so to speak, on the Internet or anything like that. Mm-hmm. Rather, and Tom knows this from his own experience, what we are trying to do is understand what the broad population thinks. So in our typical format, our first step, and this is true for all trial consultants, I would say, our first step is to go to the community in which the trial is going to occur. And someone like Tom might say, you know, I have my own thoughts about this case. I want to know what the people are thinking. Mm-hmm. What's the everyday person thinking? Mm. And that's our first mission, and that's our first value to the equation, which is our job is to go into the community, and we typically present to groups of people from the community, selected at random from the community. So these are not actual jurors. These are simply people who make up the community, mm-hmm. all of whom could be jurors, but they're not. Mm-hmm. So we present to these groups of people an overview of the case. I'm simplifying this a lot for the purpose of our amount of time we have here together.
For us Bruins, I think, is what he's saying.
Yeah. Yeah.
Fight on Bruins. That's what we like to say. Oh.
See how they are? See how they, see how those guys are, Dave Dino? He's a smart cookie, man. You're right. He's converted to Finnerty here in about 10 minutes.
Not yet.
But that's a great example. You know, you've got people everywhere who have a certain value system. They've got certain beliefs. And like it or not, those beliefs and value systems are going to impinge upon their views of a new set of facts. Mm-hmm. They want to do the right thing, as we've already said, as jurors. They want to make good decisions. They want to make fair decisions. They don't want to lose sleep at night when it's over. But they just can't help themselves. They have to be Bruins rather than Trojans. So we try to understand that. We try to understand the makeup of the typical person. That's step one. And then step two, Tom would say to me, all right, so we've found out so-and-so about my case. What do I do with it now? I have some idea because I'm a great trial lawyer, Tom would say.
So I wouldn't say that.
He wouldn't say that. He's far more modest than that. But he is a great trial lawyer, so he would instinctively know what to do with the findings of the studies. But in a general sense, the question would be, well, what do we now do with this information? So step two is to figure out how do we communicate the facts of the case, because the facts are the facts. They don't change. But how do we communicate those facts of the case to lay people in a way that they can understand them and make use of them?
Okay, you know what? I want to be a bit more specific.
All right.
Let's suppose we have an NFL football player who got banged on the head a bunch of times.
Yeah.
But he also had some other issues in life. And now the lawsuit is against the NFL for his lack of protection and so forth. What sort of questions are we going to ask this panel in the community that maybe would give us a little bit of insight onto this?
Yeah. Okay, that's fair. So hypothetically, we might ask the prospective jury panel. There's a process the listeners might want to know. There's a process known as voir dire, simply meaning to seek the truth. And the trial lawyers get an opportunity to voir dire the panel of prospective jurors in an effort to ultimately select and seat a specific panel of jurors. So the trial lawyers get to ask questions of the prospective jurors. And if you had a case like the one which Tom just described, hypothetically, you'd want to know, first at the broad level, and then we'll get specific, you'd want to know what kinds of experiences have those lay people had in their lives which might impact upon their view of this particular case. And you would then want to know, can you be fair? You know, as a juror, can you be fair given however you answer those questions? And that's the goal. So you might, now at a specific level, in that hypothetical example, one or both of the trial lawyers might ask of a prospective juror. Have you ever played sports? When? Did you play in high school? Did you play in college? Was it a focus of your life, or was it just something you did on the side? Because we want to know the intensity a person feels toward that topic. Were you ever hurt playing sports? Have you ever been hurt in other activities? Tell me about it. How have you been injured? Did you find that your injury was resolved satisfactorily? Did you have problems? Tell me about what happened. Did you go to the hospital? Did you have a long-term injury or a short-term injury? How are you today? Are you okay today? How about your children? Do you have children? Do they play sports? Any of them ever been injured? Those kinds of questions. That's the sort of thing we want to ask.
And that gives you a little background to the person's thought process that he walks into the jury room with, right?
That's exactly right. So depending upon how a layperson answers those questions, the trial team, Tom and his group, then make a decision. You know, is this person going to be fair in the case? Are they going to be willing to listen to the evidence? Or is their mind clouded by some of their past behaviors and actions? And that's how the process begins.
You are listening to Champions of Justice with Tom Girardi. Joined today by Bob Finnerty, and our guest is Dr. Philip Anthony. He is the CEO of Decision Quest. And we're talking about his work initially here in consulting with lawyers about jury selection. And we've got other areas that we will touch on later in the program, how to prepare lawyers for trial, for one, and how technology is affecting the courtroom as well. I'm Dave Dino, and boy, have we got a lot in store for you. So keep it here at Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Talk Radio 790 KABC News Update. I'm Gary Garrison. A Pomona police officer has died after he and a fellow officer were shot by a barricaded suspect in Pomona last night. The second officer is listed in stable condition. The slain officer has been identified as 25-year-old Gregory Casillas of Upland. A 39-year-old man and an 18-year-old girl holed up inside a Palmdale home after fleeing a traffic stop surrendered to authorities this morning. One of the suspects was a local gang member on probation. Searchers have recovered the body of a man who jumped into the water from the Santa Monica Pier just before 11:30 last night. The body was recovered about 9:40 this morning. KABC SoCal weather, a 70% chance of rain today and tonight. Highs lower to mid-60s, overnight lows in the mid-50s. More news coming up and continuous coverage at KABC.com. I'm Gary Garrison, Talk Radio 790 KABC News.
You know, as an allergy sufferer, you're wired differently.
I sure feel that way.
That's why there's Nasacort. It's different, too. You see, unlike antihistamines, Nasacort targets and inhibits more of the allergic inflammation that causes ear congestion and other nasal allergy symptoms.
My antihistamine doesn't do that?
None of them do.
Oh, that is different.
And it's why Nasacort's more effective at giving you 24-hour relief.
So even if I'm wired differently,
Nasacort stops more of what makes you miserable. Use as directed.
Blue Star medicated ointment works fast to relieve the pain and itch of almost any skin irritation.
It's amazing. It's like as soon as you put it on, you can feel it working.
We've had Blue Star in the family for years. It works on everything.
I love the cooling sensation on my athlete's foot.
What a relief for my eczema.
Nothing worked on my dry, cracked skin until I tried Blue Star.
Blue Star is great for scalp itch.
Look for the white box with the Blue Star in the first aid section. Feel Blue Star work fast or your money back.
Hi, this is Al Rantel. Listen Sunday mornings at 6 for On the Money. On the Money is the new show that will make you smarter about all things related to money. Brought to you by the people who can turn your house into quick cash. Their name is what they do. House today, cash tomorrow. Call 877-221-8080 and listen here Sundays at 6 a.m. or listen anytime at housetodaycashtomorrow.com.
Hey, what's going on around your house? Need a little help? A second opinion? Well, I'm here to help answer any questions you have about your home. All you have to do is call. Join me, Lou Manfredini, every Saturday morning from 8 to 9 a.m. on House Smarts Radio, right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Norm's Bigger Better Breakfasts are back for just $6.99. Bacon, eggs, sausage, ham, golden hash browns, and scratch-made buttermilk hotcakes. All day, every day for $6.99. Norm's Restaurants.
Back with more of Champions of Justice with Tom Girardi, joined by Bob Finnerty, and our guest today is the CEO of Decision Quest. He is Dr. Philip Anthony. We're talking today about juries, and we're talking about technology in the courtroom, and we're talking about what makes a lawyer a good lawyer. Tom?
You know what? So if we're just in a jury room without any background information, and I say, hey, can you be fair in this case? And the guy says, oh, yeah, I can be fair in this case. On the other hand, if you've done this work of what the people in this community think about people suing because of an athletic injury or those sorts of things, the NFL is terrible, it didn't take care of the players, or the players are terrible, they realize they made a fortune and they got bumped in the head of whatever, by doing this other sort of background, that's going to give the lawyers a little indication if there's a underlying bias or prejudice that obviously the lawyers on both sides want to get rid of, right?
Well, that's exactly right. And, Tom, you just hit upon the second category. So we were talking before the break about the general questions that one might ask to start out your dialogue with the prospective juror. But then you go to the second level, as you just did, Tom. So you might ask, well, what do you think of sports in the world today? What's your view of professional sports? How about football in particular? How about the NFL in particular? Any feelings about the NFL? How about your feelings about the kids and young adults who play professional sports in the NFL? You think they're, you know, are they treated fairly? Are they good people? These kinds of questions. So ultimately, after a series of anywhere from a few dozen to maybe 50 questions, if the court will permit the trial team to ask that many, you begin to get a picture. You begin to gather a sense of what the person is all about and the extent to which they can be fair and impartial in their decision-making in the trial.
What's your win-loss record?
What's our win-loss record?
Right. In other words, our win-loss, how many of those people that you thought would be fair later on let their biases overcame them and decided maybe in a way that wasn't fair? Versus the other way around.
Yeah, you know, I'm proud to say, statistically speaking, first of all, we've been on the winning side of about 85% of the cases in which we've been involved. We've had some losses, and we're never happy with losses, but we've been on the winning side about 85% of the time. And I like to think that in most instances, we can decipher what makes a person tick in terms of these broad categorizations. We can tell if a person is likely to be fair. We can tell if a person is likely to understand the kinds of information being presented to them. Mm-hmm. And I think it can serve as good input to the trial team in making their ultimate decision.
So it sounds to me that we're getting back to your initial comments of, when I'm a juror, I just want to do the right thing.
That's right.
And exactly. So what you're trying to do is help the lawyers get to that point, to communicate with the jurors and communicate with those jurors who are open to the concept of only the facts of the case are going to decide the case. Because I know I love the NFL. I love watching football. I would be fair in my own heart of hearts. But I'm not sure I'd be the right juror for the NFL in a case where somebody's saying I have a long-term chronic injury as a result of multiple hits to the head.
Well, that's a very good example, and that's exactly what we're trying to do. We're trying to help the trial team determine, A, what do people think? B, are there certain kinds of folks who are better for a trial than others? And then C, what do we do with all of that information? How can we best make use of our knowledge to make sure it's the right jury?
You know, you touched on something earlier when you said not all juries are right for all categories. They may, you know, will they understand the issues involved? And Tom, that's something I think we've never really talked about before, and that is different cases involve different needs of understanding on various issues. You might have a case that is very technical oriented. You might have another case that is very emotional and not quite so technical. being able to understand that and understand what kind of juror it's going to take to understand the issues, how are you able to determine that?
Well, and that's a very fair question. I think it goes back to the beginning of the process, which is consistent with what you just stated, Dave, mm-hmm. that the first step is understanding what do people think about the issues and how do they perceive the issues, and then ultimately, what's the process they engage in to make decisions about the issues in the mm-hmm. case. Mm-hmm. So a natural derivative from that process is understanding what kinds of folks are best suited to make use of the information in the case. A very simple example would be you might have a very technical case that involves issues surrounding nuclear physics or, you know, something that's a very mm-hmm. precise science. Mm-hmm. And you might have a group of jurors who by nature are the opposite of that. They're artists, they're creative people, they've been trained in English literature. And so it doesn't mean they can't be a juror. Of course they can be a juror. But it does mean that the trial team's job and the court's job is to make sure the juror has an opportunity to understand the facts of the case.
It is said in looking back at the O.J. trial, so much of the evidence in the O.J. trial was based on science. It was based on DNA evidence and other scientific presentations. And yet, the question was asked, did they pick the right jury that had any basis for understanding or learning that kind of science?
Well, that the O.J. case is a whole topic in and of itself. But to the first point you made, it's a great point on this issue, which is at that time, you know, sometimes it's hard to remember back. Life mm-hmm. moves so quickly these mm-hmm. days. In that time frame, the concept of DNA, the term DNA,
was a
brand new term mm-hmm. of art. Mm-hmm. So just to start, people had no idea what it was they were expected to know about that. You know, in other words, they could be told verbally, well, we've got the DNA of so-and-so, or we don't have the DNA of so-and-so. Mm-hmm. But the average juror in that time frame probably didn't have the background to process that information. And whereas today it might be different, right, mm-hmm. because you read so much about DNA and the whole world's familiar with DNA. But it's a good example for that reason. That's an example in which it's the trial team's duty to make certain they're educating the jury what it is that that lay juror is supposed to derive from the information about DNA being presented to them. Mm-hmm. And that's half of the job right there. And, you know, Tom Girardi and all the folks at his firm are so good at that, I have to say. You know, they understand human behavior. And that's not just Tom, but, you know, in fairness, trial lawyers in general, the very best trial lawyers instinctively know how to communicate complex information to lay people.
Tom, is it possible for a trial lawyer to overwhelm the jury with too much technical jargon, and as a result, the jury just says, "Phooey, I'm not even going to pay any attention to any of it"?
Well, no kidding, Dave Dino. Of course, you know, I think the difference between a terrific trial lawyer and a terrible trial lawyer is editing.
Ah.
Editing is the key. Mm. In other words, you don't want to go on and on and on about some useless subject. Mm-hmm. And then on these technical things, you want to translate them, you know, so that people understand. You know, listen, we're not going to be talking DNA. Who knows? How about this? There's going to be specific blood that you could look at that is going to help identify a person.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that makes sense to me, doesn't mm-hmm. it? The other DNA, what does that mean, et cetera?
Yeah.
So it's the lawyer's job. I mean, first of all, we got to get the doctor in there to tell us, you know, some of the background of these people and what they're thinking.
Mm-hmm.
But then it's the lawyer's job to do two things. A lot of times you'll end up with a juror that maybe isn't your favorite on your side of the case.
Mm-hmm.
You got to convince that guy, man, to come along with you. So what is your focus? Mm-hmm. For example, maybe we're suing a big company and you have a young corporate person on the jury. Well, the last thing that person wants to do is to go back to the office and say, I gave $3 million to somebody suing a company.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, what if an argument is made, you should come in favor of the plaintiff because the plaintiff is entitled? More importantly, this company that is involved in this case took shortcuts, absolute shortcuts. And if you're a good company, there's no way you can compete with them.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're a good company, you got to say, we don't stand for shortcuts.
Mm.
The whole focus then is not so much on the guy who wants to get the money, but rather on your fairness to companies doing the right thing. So you got to change your approach a little bit, Dave Dino.
You are listening to Champions of Justice with Tom Girardi, joined today by Bob Finnerty. And our guest is Dr. Philip Anthony. He is the CEO of Decision Quest. I'm Dave Dino. We're going to talk about technology in the courtroom in just a moment. So keep it here on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
When you join the Fuel Rewards program at Shell and get instant gold status, you'll save on every fill, every day.
But you'll feel like you just won a dance-off competition that saved the world.
That's what it feels like to have gold status with the Fuel Rewards program at Shell. With gold status, you'll save 5 cents with every gallon from the first fill. Download the Fuel Rewards app, join, and start saving today. Restrictions apply. Active gold status required. Introductory offer valid for 6 months after activation. Limit 20 gallons at participating Shell stations. See fuelrewards.com/gold for full details.
Capital One presents Da Vinci Painting Mona Lisa.
Mona, why are you so unhappy?
Ugh, I left my Capital One card in the carriage.
Un momento.
I can lock it with the Capital One app on my phone. This app, it's a masterpiece.
Ah, Mona, that smile.
Card lock from Capital One. Instantly lock your card in case it goes arrivederci. Technology this convenient could make history.
What's in your wallet?
Capital One Bank USA N.A.
Attention all authors. Page Publishing is looking for authors. Have you written a book and want to get it published? Page Publishing will get your book into bookstores and for sale online at Amazon, Apple iTunes, and other outlets. They handle all aspects of the publishing process for you. Printing, cover art, publicity, copyright, and editing. Call 800-501-3689 now for your free author submission kit. That's 800-501-3689 for your free author submission kit. Again, 800-501-3689.
Attention shoppers, cleanup on aisle 14. Cleanup on aisle 14. Someone dropped a jar of pickles. Pickles. Kosher pickles.
Beatboxing at a big box store. Surprising. What's not surprising? How much you could save by switching to Geico.
A red minivan has the lights on in the parking lot.
Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more.
Geico.
Back with more of Champions of Justice, our final segment for today. Your host is Tom Girardi, and he's joined by Bob Finnerty. And our guest is Dr. Philip Anthony. He is the CEO of Decision Quest. Bob?
Hey, thanks, Dave. At the beginning of the show, Dave Dino mentioned something about facial hair and affecting a jury's perspective or verdict. I certainly hope that isn't the case, since none of the lawyers at Girardi Keys have facial hair. But clearly you've thought about this in the past.
Yes, yes. Bob, that's an excellent topic, as one of many to get into. You know, we all, everyone, but certainly the trial team community, everyone has a favorite myth or perception of what happens in a courtroom and what lay people either like or don't like. And facial hair is a great example of that whole area of curiosity by people. So you're actually right. I think, generally speaking, what we found, and we have studied this, so this is a empirically based response on my part. The bottom line is facial hair doesn't matter to most jurors. Now, there might be some exceptions to that, but most jurors are going to leave that out of the equation. They're going to leave that factor out of the equation. We interview lots of jurors, as I'm sure your firm does too, when trials are over, and we ask them questions like that. You know, what did you think about Mr. Smith? Oh, he was, you know, he was fine. How about the way he looked? Oh, he looked fine. Well, did you notice he had a beard? Well, yeah, I guess he did, yeah. Well, what did you think of that? I didn't think anything of it. Those are the kinds of responses we typically garner from lay people about things like facial hair. And so it's good to know that that doesn't typically become an issue.
When we began, Tom, you made it very, very clear that the whole topic we're talking about is not designed to pick jurors who are going to be biased, but the very opposite, to be able to find jurors who will be able to give you a fair and impartial decision on what they're looking at. And yet, every once in a while, you may discover what, in your terminology, is a stealth juror. What is a stealth juror, and what's the danger, and how do you spot them?
Okay, well, thank you. That's an interesting topic. So years ago, by years ago, I mean in the late 80s to early 90s, we began to observe that there were certain jurors who in the population appeared to have an objective as being a juror. Now, that didn't make them a bad person, but what we discovered is there's a certain subset of the population who really wants to be a juror. In other words, they don't just want to perform their civic duty. They look at it as an opportunity to make a statement of some kind, a statement about society, a statement about the particular parties involved in the case, or whatever it may be. And again, I emphasize those individuals don't think they're doing anything wrong. This is just how they look at life. And so we discovered through some of our research that about 17% of the jury population seems to fit the category of a stealth juror, which is pretty high, one might think.
Some try to get on a jury so that they can perhaps make some money down the road?
Potentially that happens. But again, I stress, you know, I don't think the people themselves are looking at what they're doing as a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's just how they sort of approach life.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, again, going back to Tom's point about voir dire, these are the kinds of things you've got to understand. At the end of the day, you want a fair and impartial jury, and that's one component of it. You want to make sure that people don't have an ulterior motive.
And you work for both sides.
Well, that's correct. Plaintiff and defense, yes.
Right, so you're interested that the defendant's going to get a fair and impartial jury, and you're interested that the plaintiff will get a fair and impartial jury.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And it works out, doesn't it?
It does work out. And I like what you said a few minutes ago, Tom, which is you said, you know, for you, a lot of the process is editing of the trial procedure. And I would say what most lay people don't recognize is that in any given trial, there's oodles of information that could be presented to them. And the reality is the trial team has to make a decision of the boxcars full of data I've got about this trial available to me. What is it that I'm going to present to the jury? What's the most important set of information to present? How can I make sure it's presented clearly and thoroughly through the witnesses? And so editing is an important factor, and one that, you know, really is the difference between success and failure with a lot of lay jurors.
When I tried to get Julie Somas to go to the junior prom, I think the important thing was it's going to be at the Ambassador Hotel, Julie. It's really going to be great. And, you know, it's, I think you're going to really like your girlfriends that are going to be there, et cetera. And then shut up.
That's a great example. Tom could have said, you know, the menu is chicken, and for dessert there's an apple pie. And, oh, by the way, I don't have a car. I've got to borrow my dad's car. But he edited the process and selected what he thought was important.
Very good. Bob?
Oh, man. You know what? This is pretty interesting stuff, because as trial lawyers, I think our ultimate goal is that people get a fair trial and that the right thing is done. And there's people out there like yourself that are able to help lawyers achieve or accomplish that goal. I mean, I think this is something that probably not only helps or benefits lawyers, but maybe across all professions, don't you think?
Well, I like to think that, Bob. In other words, I think, you know, I think what can be better than making sure that our justice system works as it was intended to work? And part of that is making your best effort at ensuring that the jurors who are making the decisions are being provided with the tools to do so.
You know, when we watch this stuff on TV today, all too often it's portrayed as somebody trying to gain an unfair advantage. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that that's not what you're into.
No, that's absolutely right. I don't think anyone in the process, from the trial lawyers to the witnesses to folks like us who simply try to help out, all of us in the collective want to see justice done in any circumstance. And I think that's what happens in the system today. I think largely justice is served.
Technology in the courtroom. What is going on? What is the challenge there? How is it affecting the courtroom these days? And what do these two great lawyers on each side of you need to know about technology when it comes to their presentations in the courtroom?
Sure. Very great question. Thank you, Dave. Well, you know, I always like to bring up the example when that question is posed to me. I like to bring up the example of the old original Star Trek series.
Hmm.
And some people have seen Star Trek, some haven't. But any time there was a trial or a hearing in the Star Trek series, they would show the lawyers for Star Trek in a room on the ship, and the lawyer might say, play back the tape showing when the person said so-and-so.
Mm-hmm.
And magically, everything that was ever said by anyone was somehow recorded, both visually and audibly, and that would be played for the court in making its decision. Well, today, fast forward a couple of decades, the courtroom actually looks a lot like that, mm-hmm. meaning the lay people come in, they sit down, and typically there's a lot of technology in play. So there's typically a big screen, not every trial, but a lot of trials, there's a big screen up on the wall, and there are computer-based data sets of information.
Mm-hmm.
And every time a witness goes to testify, typically something that they're testifying to pops up instantly on the screen, and then some particular information is called out so that the witness's attention is focused upon it. And the jurors are following along with this. And the interesting thing is, in today's world, jurors are not finding that odd whatsoever. In fact, quite the contrary. They're thinking, well, this is, of course, what I would expect. Everything is instantaneous. Mm-hmm. When I'm at home on my own time, I go onto my computer and I can look anything up and I can get the answer to anything in a matter of moments. So they have come to expect the same behavior in the courtroom. And so it's interesting for trial lawyers. Trial lawyers who, you know, all trial lawyers have different perspectives on how it's best to try a case. But trial lawyers who do not adapt to current technology, I think, are behind a little bit in many trials, because the expectation is higher.
You're going to be back here next year, going to be sitting right there. Bob Finnerty, the UCLA guy, he'll be here. Dave Dean will be here. I'll be here.
Wonderful.
So I'm going to say, okay, doctor, what happened in this past year that you really think was very important?
You know, that's a great and fair question. I think a year down the road, it's, without commentary one direction or another, it's going to be interesting in that we're at a tipping point with the Supreme Court. And the court's going to go one way or another, and decisions are going to begin to be made. And I think some of that's going to have a trickle-down influence on everyday trials. And so it's going to be very interesting to see how that plays out.
So anyway, you're going to go back to work now. You probably have 20 trials you're looking at to help lawyers on both sides to try and get 12 people that'll do the right thing. Huh?
Like you, Tom, and like you, Dave, I'm going to go back to work, and that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to keep doing my job.
You know, Dr. Anthony, this was a real pleasure to have you. It was really nice of you to find the time. I know that this was not exactly perfect in your schedule, but it's deeply appreciated.
Well, I'm honored to have been invited onto your show, Tom. Thank you so much.
You have been listening to Champions of Justice with Tom Girardi, joined today by Bob Finnerty and our guest, Dr. Philip Anthony, CEO of Decision Quest, Inc. Our producer is Charlene Fujimoto. I'm Dave Dino. And a final thought, and it's a very interesting thought from the former mayor of Los Angeles, Antonio Villaraigosa. The great thing about our system of democracy is when they call you for jury duty, you have to come. It's an honor and a privilege. I was called, and I've got to be here. Well, it is our hope that today, listening to this program, when you are called for jury duty, you will say, I've got to be there. And that is what our guest brings to the table as a champion of justice. Thank you for joining us.
This show furnished by Girardi Keys.